The first reading is from the book of Isaiah, chapter 41, verses 17 through 20. Hear the word of the Lord. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together, so that all may see and know, all may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Well, good morning to you all. Just a moment of personal privilege to say how delighted I am to be here. My wife and I have had a place in Cambridge for 20 years. I have heard so much about this congregation, but not until today did you allow me to come inside. And I'm delighted to be here. Our New Testament lesson is one of the parables of Jesus. Jesus taught in a lot of different ways, Beatitudes, Proverbs, through his action. But his favorite method of teaching was parables. He didn't invent the parable. He inherited that from his Jewish forebears, but he packed them with power. In fact, Clarence Jordan, who's one of the co-founders of Habitat for Humanity, said whenever Jesus told a parable, he lit a stick of dynamite and covered it with a story. Here in the 16th chapter of Luke is one of Jesus' most provocative parables. Listen to this. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. At his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried, and in Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. I'm in agony in these flames." But Abraham said, "Oh, my child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things and Lazarus in like manner evil things, but now he is comforted here and you are in agony. Beside all this, between you and us, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us." He said, "Then, Father, I beg you, send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets, they should listen to them." He said, "No, Father, if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, let me begin by admitting that I don't think it's going to be easy to figure out exactly what Jesus wants us to get out of this parable. Or any of the parables, really. The word parable is a notoriously difficult word to define. It means a lot of things. But one of the best definitions of parable is riddle. A parable is a riddle. There's some puzzle to be resolved, some enigma to be plumbed. And the thing about Jesus' parables, right when you think you've got it, a trap door opens, and you fall down to an even deeper level of meaning. By the way, I think insufficient attention is given to the fact that we serve a Lord whose favorite method of teaching was not rule, law, clear principle, but riddle. The writer of the Gospel of Mark didn't exaggerate much when he said, he never said anything except in riddles. I think that bothered his disciples. We are told that one day Jesus was beside the Sea of Galilee, preaching and teaching, one parable, one riddle after another. And when he was done, his disciples pulled him aside and said, "Why'd you do that? Why do you talk to them in riddles?" Almost as if to say, "Why aren't you like the other teachers? If you've got something to say, just say it directly." But no, he never said anything except in riddles. The humorist Calvin Trillin once said that he failed high school math because his teacher never understood that he meant his answers ironically. Well, so did Jesus, evidently. He never said anything except in riddles. The great New Testament scholar C.H. Dodd once came up with a beautiful definition of a parable. He said, "A parable is a metaphor or simile drawn from everyday life, the meaning of which is sufficiently in doubt to tease the imagination into thought." You get that? Sufficiently in doubt to tease the imagination into thought. But even in the weird world of parables, this riddle that we're looking at this morning is particularly odd. Sometimes people say that a parable is an earthly story, a very earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Well, not this one. Most of the action in this parable takes place not in this world, but the next world. In fact, instead of saying that this is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, this one's kind of a heavenly story, or actually a sort of a hellish story. Most of the dialogue comes from the bowels of Hades. What happens in this riddle is that there is a rich man. We don't know his name, but Luke tells us how he lives. He wears designer clothing, and he eats sumptuously every day. Right at his gate, right at his front door, right on his porch, there is a poor homeless beggar by the name of Lazarus, so miserable and hungry that he would love to have pawed through the hefty garbage bags that go out the back door of the mansion every day. But no, there's no indication that the rich man ever saw him, noticed him, paid him any mind. They live only a few feet apart, but they're in different worlds. But then, as is so often the case in Jesus' parables, there is a sudden reversal of fortune. Lazarus dies, and what the Greek says is, he's carried by the angels into the bosom of Abraham. That's an old Jewish phrase meaning right into the heart of God's family, right next to the heart of God. The rich man also dies, but he heads in the other direction. He ends up in the old Jewish underworld, the land of the dead, Hades, a place of misery and torment. And in Hades, he looks up, and what does he see? That beggar, Lazarus, right in Abraham's bosom. And so he calls out, "Father Abraham, please, I'm in agony here. Send Lazarus with some water to cool my tongue." But Abraham says, "Oh, my child, no. In life, you've had your good things. And what is more, a great chasm has been fixed between us. You can't come to us now. And those of us who would dearly love to come to you, we cannot. It's too late. It's too late. It's too late." Well, what do you think Jesus wants us to get out of that riddle? Well, a good many New Testament scholars say that this story fits beautifully into a major theme, a major motif in the Gospel of Luke. Luke's theology is that in the age-old struggle between the rich and the poor, between the haves and the have-nots, God is not neutral. God stands on the side of the poor. They have no one else to stand with them, and God stands with them. And it's true. If we read through the Gospel of Luke with open eyes and an open mind and an open heart, there's more material in Luke on what we might call economic justice than almost anywhere else in the Scripture. In fact, it's such a strong theme that you get the feeling that every time Luke uses the word rich, he snorts with contempt. It's true. You may remember at the beginning of Luke, the angel Gabriel comes to the little peasant girl Mary to say to her, "Good news, you're going to be the mother of the Messiah." And when she overcomes her fear, she breaks out in song. We call it the Magnificat. Maybe the choir sings it here at Christmas time. But it's not really a gentle mother's lullaby. It's more like "We Shall Overcome." It's a political protest song. She sings, "My soul Magnificat magnifies the Lord." Why? Because God has brought the high and mighty down from their thrones and lifted up the lowly and the weak. The hungry God has filled with good things, and the rich God has sent empty away. Right before Jesus tells our story, he has a fight with the local clergy. What he says to them is, "You know what's wrong with you ministers? I'll tell you what's wrong with you ministers. You're trying to serve two gods, God and money, God and mammon, God and prosperity. Well, you can't do it. They are rival gods. They both want your soul. So what's it going to be, God or money?" Maybe, just maybe, our story is the tragic tale of a man who made the wrong decision. And if that's what Jesus wants us to get out of this riddle, I have to tell you, I find that somewhat satisfying. You've been seeing the stories in the news that I have about how these big pharmaceutical companies, out of absolute greed, basically bribed physicians to overprescribe opioids. They didn't care how many families they destroyed, how many communities they tore apart, how many lives they ruined. It was all about money. You've read that. Or maybe you read the same story several years ago that I did about the professional basketball player in Philadelphia who owes the city of Philadelphia thousands of dollars in unpaid parking fines because he parks his luxury cars wherever he wants to. One of the tickets was for parking his Rolls Royce at Philadelphia Airport for 2 weeks in a handicap slot. And if what Jesus is saying is that one day greedy and selfish people like that will stand before the bar of God's justice and God will say, "All right, Buster, you've had all the good things in life you're ever going to have," there's something in me that says, yeah. There are only two things that keep me from stopping there. The first is the chill of recognition. Look, I do not think of myself as a rich man. I don't. I have spent all of my adult life as a preacher and a teacher, and believe me, I have been paid accordingly. I don't think of myself as a rich man. But if you pull the camera back and look at me in relationship to the population of the whole earth, I'm pretty near the top of the pyramid. Or in terms of our story, I have a whole closet full of nice clothes, and I eat pretty much what I want to every day. Whatever this has to say to the rich, it has to say to me. The other thing that keeps me from stopping there is that Jesus doesn't stop there. Luke doesn't stop there. No sooner has Jesus told our story then he gets on the road to Jerusalem, and it takes him soon through the town of Jericho. And in Jericho, he encounters an honest-to-goodness rich man. His name is Zacchaeus. He is muscle for the Roman IRS. or as Luke puts it, he was the chief tax collector, and he was rich. But he wanted to see Jesus. And so he climbed up in a sycamore tree where he knew Jesus would be passing along. And when Jesus got under that tree, he looked up and saw Zacchaeus up there. And he did not say to him, "All right, Buster, you've had all the good things in life you're ever going to have." What he said to him was, "Come on down, Zacchaeus. I'm going to stay at your house today." And before that day was over, Zacchaeus was jumping for joy and justice. And Jesus was saying, "Today salvation has come even to this house, because this man too is in the bosom of Abraham." Chunk, the trap door just opened. Is our story about wealth and poverty? Yeah, I think it is. But it's also about something even deeper. I think the clue comes in what Abraham said to that rich man. Remember? He said, "Oh, my child." That's not the voice of an angry judge. That's the voice of a heartbroken parent. Oh, my child, I want to come to you, but I can't. I think what this is about is what might be called the penultimate theology of the gospel, the next to last theology of the gospel. The ultimate theology of the gospel is that it's never too late. The mercy of God is from everlasting to everlasting. It is never too late. The prodigal son, the prodigal daughter can always come home to the embrace of God. It's never too late. But that would be cheap grace if it were not for the next to last theology of the gospel. That every now and then, in important ways in our lives, God opens up a window of blessing and righteousness, giving us an opportunity to be a part of what God is doing in the world, right there, right then. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But then the window closes and it's too late. The Pulitzer Prize winning author Tracy Kidder wrote a fascinating book a number of years ago called Old Friends. It's about life in a New England nursing home. He actually lived in a Boston nursing home for a year doing research. And in that book he said, "There are a lot of people in this nursing home who suffer from the loss of memory. But there's one man here who suffers from the inability to lose memory. His name is Art. He has just lost his wife of 60 years, and he's tormented by memories of failure in their marriage. When they were newlyweds, she accidentally dropped the frying pan one morning, and he cursed her. If I could have her back, she could drop 100 frying pans. I wouldn't say a thing." He's tormented by the memories of an argument that went on all 60 years in their marriage. She wanted him to tell her more that he loved her. "I don't like to talk about it," he'd say. "I just like to show it." Well, sweetheart, sometimes I need to hear it. "Oh, well, that ain't my way. I don't like to talk about it." The last week of her life, she went into a coma, and he sat beside her bed, saying over and over, "I love you, I love you." She never heard me, she never forgave me. The day she died, he was watching television in their room. "The Red Sox are losing the..." "I would have liked it," he said, "if she had died in my arms." Some of us understand this very personally. You know, I can't believe that when I was a young father, I can't believe this. When I was a young father, I actually got on that airplane and flew somewhere to give a speech to people who no longer remember me or what I said, rather than going to the father-daughter campfire girl banquet that my little girl Melanie was begging me to go to with her. I can't believe I did that. And now that I'm older and maybe a little wiser, I know I made the wrong choice. So I am now ready to go to the father-daughter campfire girl banquet. To which Melanie would say, "Oh, Dad, I'm all grown up now. I'm not that little girl anymore who so desperately needed her father that night. You missed it." I think when Jesus was a boy, he heard a lot of sermons like this because it was a favorite theme of the old rabbis in the synagogue. They used to love to talk about how God would open up a window of blessing and then give people an opportunity to participate in the ways of God, and then would close the window and it would be too late. They even had their favorite sermon illustrations. They were called Eliezer of Damascus stories. Who's Eliezer of Damascus? Eliezer of Damascus is an obscure biblical character. He's mentioned once by name in Genesis. He was Abraham's cousin and Abraham's right-hand man, but the rabbis made up stories about him. How when God wanted to bless the earth, he would say to Father Abraham, "I want you to send your servant Eliezer of Damascus to earth as a blessing and to hew out the ways of righteousness." And Abraham would do it. But Eliezer of Damascus always came incognito. He was the tailor or the goat herd or the guy buying plumbing supplies at Lowe's. You have to keep your eyes open if you see Eliezer. Oh, by the way, if you translate the name from Hebrew, Eliezer, into Greek, it's Lazarus. The blessing of God on the front porch. The way of God on the front porch. The rich man needed Lazarus a lot more than Lazarus needed the rich man, but he missed it. Why did he miss it? Same reason we do. He was too rich, too turned in on himself, too numb to the possibility that God might be trying to break through his life with a blessing. And he missed it. A friend of mine was watching television with her teenage son recently. She was folding her laundry. They were watching something stupid on TV. And in the middle of it, her son turned to her and said something mildly smart. And it didn't sit well with her. And so she scolded him a little bit. Well, he didn't like being scolded, so he said something really smart to her. She really didn't like that. And scolded him hard, and at that point, he brought his fist down on the coffee table in anger, jumped up and ran upstairs to his room and slammed the door. And she thought to herself, "Well, you can just stew in your juices." But then something told her that there was nothing in the world more important at that moment than making peace with her son. So she put down her laundry, and she put down her pride, and she went upstairs and made peace. Don't miss it. Don't miss it.